winnowed in the wind, but one conceals one's own faults as a cunning gambler conceals his dice. End quote. Jesus and Buddha were right, and in this chapter and the next one, I'll show you how our automatic self-righteousness works. It begins with rapid and compelling intuitions. That's link one in the social intuitionist model. And it continues on with post hoc reasoning done for socially strategic purposes. That's links two and three. Here are six major research findings that collectively illustrate the first half of the first principle. Intuitions come first. In the next chapter, I'll give evidence for the second half. Strategic reasoning second. Elephants rule, although they are sometimes open to persuasion by rioters. Research finding number one, brains evaluate instantly and constantly. Brains evaluate everything in terms of potential threat or benefit to the self, and then adjust behavior to get more of the good stuff and less of the bad. Animal brains make such appraisal thousands of times a day with no need for conscious reasoning, all in order to optimize the brain's answer to the fundamental question of animal life, approach or avoid. In the 1890s, Wilhelm Wundt, the founder of experimental psychology, formulated the doctrine of affective primacy. Affect refers to small flashes of positive or negative feeling that prepare us to approach or avoid something. Every emotion, such as happiness or disgust, includes an affective reaction, but most of our affective reactions are too fleeting to be called emotions. For example, the subtle feelings you get just from hearing the words happiness and disgust. Wundt said that affective reactions are so tightly integrated with perception that we find ourselves liking or disliking something the instant we notice it, sometimes even before we know what it is. These flashes occur so rapidly that they precede all other thoughts about the thing we're looking at. You can feel affective primacy in action the next time you run into someone you haven't seen in many years. You'll usually know within a second or two whether you liked or disliked the person, but it can take much longer to remember who the person is or how you know each other. In 1980, social psychologist Robert Zients revived Wundt's long-forgotten notion of affective primacy. Zients was fed up with the common view among psychologists at the time that people are cool, rational information processors who first perceive and categorize objects and then react to them. He did a number of ingenious experiments that asked people to rate arbitrary things, such as Japanese pictograms, words in a made-up language, and geometric shapes. It may seem odd to ask people to rate how much they like foreign words and meaningless squiggles, but people can do it because almost everything we look at triggers a tiny flash of affect. More important, Zients was able to make people like any word or image more just by showing it to them several times. The brain tags familiar things as good things. Zients called this the mere exposure effect, and it is a basic principle of advertising. In a landmark article, Zients urged psychologists to use a dual process model in which affect or feeling is the first process. It has primacy both because it happens first, it is part of perception and is therefore extremely fast, and because it is more powerful. It is closely linked to motivation, and therefore it strongly influences behavior. The second process, thinking, is an evolutionarily newer ability, rooted in language and not closely related to motivation. In other words, thinking is the rider, affect is the elephant. The thinking system is not equipped to lead. It simply doesn't have the power to make things happen. But it can be a useful advisor. Zients said that thinking could work independently of feeling in theory, but in practice, affective reactions are so fast and compelling that they act like blinders on a horse. They reduce the universe of alternatives available to later thinking. The rider is an attentive servant, always trying to anticipate the elephant's next move. If the elephant leans even slightly to the left, as though preparing to take a step, the rider looks to the left and starts preparing to assist the elephant on its imminent leftward journey. The rider loses interest in everything off to the right. Research finding number two. Social and political judgments are particularly intuitive. Here are four pairs of words. Your job is to listen only to the second word in each pair and then categorize it as good or bad. Flower, happiness. Hate, sunshine. Love, cancer. Cockroach Lonely. It's absurdly easy, but imagine if I asked you to do it on a computer where I can flash the first word in each pair for 250 milliseconds, a quarter of a second, just long enough to read it. And then I immediately display the second word. In that case, we'd find that it takes you longer to make your value judgment for sunshine and cancer than for happiness and lonely. This effect is called affective priming because the first word triggers a flash of affect that primes the mind to go one way or the other. It's like getting the elephant to lean slightly to the right or the left in anticipation of walking to the right or the left. The flash kicks in within 200 milliseconds, and it lasts for about a second beyond that if there's no other jolt to back it up. If you see the second word within that brief window of time, and if the second word has the same valence, then you'll be able to respond extra quickly because your mind is already leaning that way. But if the first word primes your mind for a negative evaluation, hate, and I then show you a positive word, sunshine, it'll take you about 250 milliseconds longer to respond because you have to undo the lean towards negativity. So far, this is just a confirmation of Zients' theory about the speed and ubiquity of affect. But a big payoff came when social psychologists began using social groups as primes. Would it affect your response speed if I used photographs of black people and white people as the primes? As long as you're not prejudiced, it won't affect your reaction times. But if you do prejudge people implicitly, that is, automatically and unconsciously, then those prejudgments include affective flashes, and those flashes will change your reaction times. The most widely used measure of these implicit attitudes is the Implicit Association Test, the IAT, developed by Tony Greenwald, Mazarin Banaji, and my UVA colleague, Brian Nosek. You can take the IAT yourself at projectimplicit.org, but be forewarned, it can be disturbing. You can actually feel yourself moving more slowly when you are asked to associate good things with the faces of one race rather than another. You can watch as your implicit attitude contradicts your explicit values. Most people turn out to have negative implicit associations with many social groups, such as black people, immigrants, obese people, and the elderly. And if the elephant tends to lean away from groups such as the elderly, whom few would condemn morally, then we should certainly expect some leaning or prejudging when people think about their political enemies. To look for such effects, my UVA colleague Jamie Morris measured the brain waves of liberals and conservatives as they read politically loaded words. He replaced the words flower and hate in the example I read you before with words such as Clinton, Bush, flag, taxes, welfare, and pro-life. When partisans read these words, followed immediately by words that everyone agrees are good, like sunshine, or bad, like cancer, their brains sometimes revealed a conflict. Pro-life and sunshine were effectively incongruous for liberals, just as Clinton and sunshine were for conservatives. The words pro and life are both positive on their own, but part of what it means to be a partisan is that you have acquired the right set of intuitive reactions to hundreds of words and phrases. Your elephant knows which way to lean in response to terms such as pro-life, and as your elephant sways back and forth throughout the day, you find yourself liking and trusting the people around you who sway in sync with you. The intuitive nature of political judgments is even more striking in the work of Alex Todorov at Princeton. Todorov studies how we form impressions of people. When he began his work, there was already a lot of research showing that we judge attractive people to be smarter and more virtuous, and we are more likely to give a pretty face the benefit of any doubt. Juries are more likely to acquit attractive defendants, and when beautiful people are convicted, judges give them lighter sentences on average. That's normal effective primacy, making everyone lean toward the defendant, which tips off their riders to interpret the evidence in a way that will support the elephant's desire to acquit. But Todorov found that there was more going on than just attractiveness. He collected photographs of the winners and runners-up in hundreds of elections for the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives. He showed people the pairs of photographs from each contest with no information about political party, and he asked them to pick which person seemed more competent. He found that the candidate that people judged more competent was the one who actually won the race about two-thirds of the time. People's snap judgments of the candidate's physical attractiveness and overall likability were not as good predictors of victory, So these competence judgments were not just based on an overall feeling of positivity. We can have multiple intuitions arising simultaneously, each one processing a different kind of information. And strangely, when Todorov forced people to make their competence judgments after flashing the pair of pictures on the screen for just a tenth of a second, not long enough to let their eyes fixate on each image, their snap judgments of competence predicted the real outcomes just as well. Whatever the brain is doing, it's doing it instantly, just like when you look at the Mueller-Lyer illusion. The bottom line is that human minds, like animal minds, are constantly reacting intuitively to everything they perceive and basing their responses on those reactions. Within the first second of seeing, hearing, or meeting another person, the elephant has already begun to lean toward or away, and that lean influences what you think and do next. Intuitions come first. Research finding number 3, our bodies guide our judgments. One way to reach the elephant is through its trunk. The olfactory nerve carries signals about odors to the insular cortex, also known as the insula, a region along the bottom surface of the frontal part of the brain. This part of the brain used to be known as the gustatory cortex because in all mammals it processes information from the nose and the tongue. It helps guide the animal toward the right foods and away from the wrong ones. But in humans, this ancient food processing center has taken on new duties, and it now guides our taste in people. It gets more active when we see something morally fishy, particularly something disgusting, as well as garden variety unfairness. If we had some sort of tiny electrode that could be threaded up through people's noses and into their insulas, we could then control their elephants, making them steer away from whatever they were viewing at the moment when we pressed the button. We've got such an electrode. It's called fart spray. Alex Jordan, a grad student at Stanford, came up with the idea of asking people to make moral judgments while he secretly tripped their disgust alarms. He stood at a pedestrian intersection on the Stanford campus and asked passersby to fill out a short survey. It asked people to make judgments about 4 controversial issues, such as marriage between first cousins, or a film studio's decision to release a documentary with a director who had tricked some people into being interviewed. Alex stood right next to a trash can he had emptied. Before he recruited each subject, he put a new plastic liner into the metal can. Before half of the people walked up, and before they could see him, he sprayed the fart spray twice into the bag, which perfumed the whole intersection for a few minutes. Before other recruitments, he left the empty bag unsprayed. Sure enough, people made harsher judgments when they were breathing in foul air. Other researchers have found the same effect by asking subjects to fill out questionnaires after drinking bitter versus sweet drinks. As my UVA colleague Jerry Clore puts it, we use affect as information. When we're trying to decide what we think about something, we look inward at how we're feeling. If I'm feeling good, I must like it. And if I'm feeling anything unpleasant, that must mean I don't like it. You don't even need to trigger feelings of disgust to get these effects. Simply washing your hands will do it. Chenbo Zhang at the University of Toronto has shown that subjects who are asked to wash their hands with soap before filling out questionnaires become more moralistic about issues related to moral purity, such as pornography and drug use. Once you're clean, you want to keep dirty things far away. Zhang has also shown the reverse process. Immorality makes people want to get clean. People who are asked to recall their own moral transgressions, or merely to copy by hand an account of someone else's moral transgressions, find themselves thinking about cleanliness more often and wanting more strongly to cleanse themselves. They are more likely to select hand wipes and other cleaning products when given a choice of consumer products to take home with them after the experiment. Zhang calls this the Macbeth effect, named for Lady Macbeth's obsession with water and cleansing after she goads her husband into murdering King Duncan. She goes from, "A little water clears us of this deed," to, "Out, damned spot, out, I say." In other words, there's a two-way street between our bodies and our righteous minds. Immorality makes us feel physically dirty, and cleansing ourselves can sometimes make us more concerned about guarding our moral purity. In one of the most bizarre demonstrations of this effect, Eric Helzer and David Pizarro asked students at Cornell University to fill out surveys about their political attitudes while standing near or far from a hand sanitizer dispenser. Those told to stand near the sanitizer became temporarily more conservative. Moral judgment is not a purely cerebral affair in which we weigh concerns about harm, rights, and justice. It's a kind of rapid, automatic process more akin to the judgments animals make as they move through the world, feeling themselves drawn toward or away from various things. Moral judgment is mostly done by the elephant. Research finding number 4. Psychopaths reason but don't feel. Roughly 1 in 100 men, and many fewer women, are psychopaths. Most are not violent, but the ones who are commit nearly half of the most serious crimes, such as serial murder, serial rape, and the killing of police officers. Robert Hare, a leading researcher, defines psychopathy by two sets of features. There's the unusual stuff that psychopaths do, impulsive antisocial behavior beginning in childhood, and there are the moral emotions that psychopaths lack. They feel no compassion, guilt, shame, or even embarrassment, which makes it easy for them to lie and to hurt family, friends, and animals. Psychopaths do have some emotions. When Hare asked one man if he ever felt his heart pound or stomach churn, he responded, "Of course, I'm not a robot. I really get pumped up when I have sex or when I get into a fight." But psychopaths don't show emotions that indicate that they care about other people. Psychopaths seem to live in a world of objects, some of which happen to walk around on two legs. One psychopath told Hare about a murder he committed while burglarizing an elderly man's home. "I was rummaging around when this old geezer comes downstairs and he starts yelling and having a fucking fit. So I pop him one in the head and he still doesn't shut up. So I give him a chop to the throat and he, like, staggers back and falls on the floor. He's gurgling and making sounds like a stuck pig, and he's really getting on my fucking nerves. So I boot him a few times in the head. That shut him up. I'm pretty tired by now, so I grab a few beers from the fridge and turn on the TV and fall asleep. The cops woke me up." The ability to reason, combined with a lack of moral emotions, is dangerous. Psychopaths learn to say whatever gets them what they want. The serial killer Ted Bundy, for example, was a psychology major in college, where he volunteered on a crisis hotline. On those phone calls, he learned how to speak to women and gain their trust. Then he raped, mutilated, and murdered at least 30 young women before being captured in 1978. Psychopathy does not appear to be caused by poor mothering or early trauma, or to have any other nurture-based explanation. It's a genetically heritable condition that creates brains that are unmoved by the needs, suffering, or dignity of others. The elephant doesn't respond with the slightest lean to the gravest injustice. The rider is perfectly normal. He does strategic reasoning quite well. But the rider's job is to serve the elephant, not to act as a moral compass. Research finding number 5. Babies feel but don't reason. Psychologists used to assume that infant minds were blank slates. The world babies enter is one great blooming, buzzing confusion, as William James put it, and they spend the next few years trying to make sense of it all. But when developmental psychologists invented ways to look into infant minds, they found a great deal of writing already on that slate. The trick was to see what surprises babies. Infants as young as 2 months old will look longer at an event that surprises them than at an event they were expecting. If everything is a buzzing confusion, then everything should be equally surprising. But if the infant's mind comes already wired to interpret events in certain ways, then infants can be surprised when the world violates their expectations. Using this trick, psychologists discovered that infants are born with some knowledge of physics and mechanics. They expect that objects will move according to Newton's laws of motion, and they get startled when psychologists show them scenes that should be physically impossible, such as a toy car seeming to pass through a solid object. Psychologists know this because infants stare longer at impossible scenes than at similar but less magical scenes, such as seeing the toy car pass just behind the solid object. Babies seem to have some innate ability to process events in their physical world, the world of objects. But when psychologists dug deeper, they found that infants come equipped with innate abilities to understand their social world as well. They understand things like harming and helping. Yale psychologists Kylie Hamlin, Karen Wynn, and Paul Bloom put on puppet shows for 6- and 10-month-old infants in which a climber, a wooden shape with eyes glued to it, struggled to climb up a hill. Sometimes a second puppet came along and helped the climber from below. Other times a different puppet appeared at the top of the hill and repeatedly bashed the climber down the slope. A few minutes later, the infant saw a new puppet show. This time, the climber looked back and forth between the helper puppet and the hinderer puppet, and then it decided to cozy up to the hinderer. To the infants, that was the social equivalent of seeing a car pass through a solid box. It made no sense, and the infants stared longer than when the climber decided to cozy up to the helper. At the end of the experiment, the helper and hinderer puppets were placed on a tray in front of the infants. The infants were much more likely to reach out for the helper. If the infants weren't parsing their social world, they wouldn't have cared which puppet they picked up. But they clearly wanted the nice puppet. The researchers concluded that, quote, "the capacity to evaluate individuals on the basis of their social interactions is universal and unlearned," end quote. It makes sense that infants can easily learn who is nice to them. Puppies can do that too. But these findings suggest that by 6 months of age, infants are watching how people behave toward other people, and they are developing a preference for those who are nice rather than those who are mean. In other words, the elephant begins making something like moral judgments during infancy, long before language and reasoning arrive. Looking at the discoveries from infants and psychopaths at the same time, it's clear that moral intuitions emerge very early and are necessary for moral development. The ability to reason emerges much later, and when moral reasoning is not accompanied by moral intuition, the results are ugly. Research finding number 6. Affective reactions are in the right place at the right time in the brain. Damasio's studies of brain-damaged patients show that the emotional areas of the brain are the right places to be looking for the foundations of morality, because losing them interferes with moral competence. The case would be even stronger if these areas were active at the right times. Do they become more active just before someone makes a moral judgment or decision? In 1999, Joshua Green, who was then a graduate student in philosophy at Princeton, teamed up with leading neuroscientist Jonathan Cohen to see what actually happens in the brain as people make moral judgments. He studied moral dilemmas in which two major ethical principles seem to push against each other. For example, you've probably heard of the famous trolley dilemma, in which the only way you can stop a runaway trolley from killing 5 people is by pushing one person off a bridge onto the track below. Philosophers have long disagreed about whether it's acceptable to harm one person in order to help or save several people. Utilitarianism is the philosophical school that says you should always aim to bring about the greatest total good, even if a few people get hurt along the way. So if there's really no other way to save those 5 lives, go ahead and push. Other philosophers believe that we have duties to respect the rights of individuals, and we must not harm people in our pursuit of other goals, even moral goals such as saving lives. This view is known as deontology, from the Greek root that gives us our word duty. Deontologists talk about high moral principles derived and justified by careful reasoning. They would never agree that these principles are merely post hoc rationalizations of gut feelings. But Green had a hunch that gut feelings were what often drove people to make deontological judgments, whereas utilitarian judgments were more cool and calculating. To test his hunch, Green wrote 20 stories that, like the trolley story, involved direct personal harm, usually done for a good reason. For example, should you throw an injured person out of a lifeboat to keep the boat from sinking and drowning the other passengers? All of these stories were written to produce a strong negative affective flash. Green also wrote 20 stories involving impersonal harm, such as a version of the trolley dilemma in which you save the 5 people by flipping a switch that diverts the trolley onto a sidetrack where it will kill just one person. It's the same objective trade-off of one life for 5, so some philosophers say that these 2 cases are morally equivalent, but from an intuitionist perspective, there's a world of difference. Without that initial flash of horror, that bare-handed push, the subject is free to examine both options and choose the one that saves the most lives. Green brought 18 subjects into an fMRI scanner and presented each of his stories on the screen one at a time. Each person had to press one of 2 buttons to indicate whether or not it was appropriate for a person to take the course of action described, for example, to push the man or throw the switch. The results were clear and compelling. When people read stories involving personal harm, they showed greater activity in several regions of the brain related to emotional processing. Across many stories, the relative strength of these emotional reactions predicted the average moral judgment. Green published this now famous study in 2001 in the journal Science. Since then, many other labs have put people into fMRI scanners and asked them to look at photographs about moral violations, make charitable donations, assign punishments for crimes, or play games with cheaters and cooperators. With few exceptions, the results tell a consistent story. The areas of the brain involved in emotional processing activate almost immediately, and high activity in these areas correlates with the kinds of moral judgments or decisions that people ultimately make. In an article titled "The Secret Joke of Kant's Soul," Green summed up what he and many others had found. Green did not know what E.O. Wilson had said about philosophers consulting their emotive centers when he wrote the article, but his conclusion was the same as Wilson's. Quote, "We have strong feelings that tell us in clear and certain terms that some things simply cannot be done and that other things simply must be done. But it's not obvious how to make sense of those feelings, and so we, with the help of some especially creative philosophers, make up a rationally appealing story about rights." End quote. This is a stunning example of consilience. Wilson had prophesied in 1975 that ethics would soon be biologicized and refounded as the interpretation of the activity of the emotive centers of the brain. When he made that prophecy, he was going against the dominant views of his time. Psychologists such as Kohlberg said that the action in ethics was in reasoning, not emotion. And the political climate was harsh for people such as Wilson, who dared to suggest that evolutionary thinking was a valid way to examine human behavior. Yet in the 33 years between the Wilson and Green quotes, everything changed. Scientists in many fields began recognizing the power and intelligence of automatic processes, including emotion. Evolutionary psychology became respectable, not in all academic departments, but at least among the interdisciplinary community of scholars that now studies morality. In the last few years, the new synthesis that Wilson predicted back in 1975 has arrived. Elephants are sometimes open to reason. I have argued that the Humean model, reason is a servant, fits the facts better than the Platonic model, reason could and should rule, or the Jeffersonian model, head and heart are co-emperors. But when Hume said that reason is the slave of the passions, I think he went too far. A slave is never supposed to question his master, but most of us can think of times when we questioned and revised our first intuitive judgment. The rider and elephant metaphor works well here. The rider evolved to serve the elephant, but it's a dignified partnership, more like a lawyer serving a client than a slave serving a master. Good lawyers do what they can to help their clients, but they sometimes refuse to go along with requests. Perhaps the request is impossible, such as finding a reason to condemn Dan, the student council president, at least for most of the people in my hypnosis experiment. Perhaps the request is self-destructive, as when the elephant wants a third piece of cake and the rider refuses to go along and find an excuse. The elephant is far more powerful than the rider, but it is not an absolute dictator. When does the elephant listen to reason? The main way that we change our minds on moral issues is by interacting with other people. We are terrible at seeking evidence that challenges our own beliefs, but other people do us this favor, just as we are quite good at finding errors in other people's beliefs. When discussions are hostile, the odds of change are slight. The elephant leans away from the opponent, and the rider works frantically to rebut the opponent's charges. But if there is affection, admiration, or a desire to please the other person, then the elephant leans toward that person, and the rider tries to find the truth in the other person's arguments. The elephant may not often change its direction in response to objections from its own rider, but it is easily steered by the mere presence of friendly elephants. That's the social persuasion link in the social intuitionist model. Or by good arguments given to it by the riders of those friendly elephants. That's the reasoned persuasion link. There are even times when we change our minds on our own, with no help from other people. Sometimes we have conflicting intuitions about something, as many people do about abortion and other controversial issues. Depending on which victim, which argument, or which friend you are thinking about at a given moment, your judgment may flip back and forth as if you were looking at a necrocube, figure 3.1. That's the well-known figure of a box that seems to turn inside out. And finally, it is possible for people simply to reason their way to a moral conclusion that contradicts their initial intuitive judgment, although I believe this process is rare. I know of only one study that has demonstrated this overruling experimentally, and its findings are revealing. Joe Paxton and Josh Green asked Harvard students to judge the story about Julie and Mark that I told you in Chapter 2. They supplied half of the subjects with a really bad argument to justify consensual incest. If Julie and Mark make love, then there is more love in the world. They gave the other half a stronger supporting argument about how the aversion to incest is really caused by an ancient evolutionary adaptation for avoiding birth defects in a world without contraception, but because Julie and Mark use contraception, that concern is not relevant. You'd think that Harvard students would be more persuaded by a good reason than a bad reason, but it made no difference. The elephant leaned as soon as subjects heard the story. The rider then found a way to rebut the argument, good or bad, and subjects condemned the story equally in both cases. But Paxton and Green added a twist to the experiment. Some subjects were not allowed to respond right away. The computer forced them to wait for 2 minutes before they could declare their judgment about Julie and Mark. For these subjects, the elephant leaned, but quick, effective flashes don't last for 2 minutes. While the subject was sitting there staring at the screen, the lean diminished and the rider had the time and freedom to think about the supporting argument. People who were forced to reflect on the weak argument still ended up condemning Julie and Mark, slightly more than people who got to answer immediately. But people who were forced to reflect on the good argument for 2 minutes actually did become substantially more tolerant toward Julie and Mark's decision to have sex. The delay allowed the rider to think for himself and to decide upon a judgment that, for many subjects, was contrary to the elephant's initial inclination. In other words, under normal circumstances, the rider takes its cue from the elephant, just as a lawyer takes instructions from a client. But if you force the two to sit around and chat for a few minutes, the elephant actually opens up to advice from the rider and arguments from outside sources. Intuitions come first, and under normal circumstances, they cause us to engage in socially strategic reasoning. But there are ways to make the relationship more of a two-way street. In sum, the first principle of moral psychology is intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. In support of this principle, I reviewed 6 areas of experimental research demonstrating that 1. Brains evaluate instantly and constantly, as Wundt and Zients said. 2. Social and political judgments depend heavily on quick intuitive flashes, as Todorov and work with the IAT have shown. 3. Our bodily states sometimes influence our moral judgments. Bad smells and tastes can make people more judgmental, as can anything that makes people think about purity and cleanliness. 4. Psychopaths reason but don't feel and are severely deficient morally. 5. Babies feel but don't reason and have the beginnings of morality. 6. Affective reactions are in the right place at the right time in the brain, as shown by Damasio, Green, and a wave of more recent studies. Putting all 6 together gives us a pretty clear portrait of the rider and the elephant and the roles they play in our righteous minds. The elephant, automatic processes, is where most of the action is in moral psychology. Reasoning matters, of course, particularly between people, and particularly when reasons trigger new intuitions. Elephants rule, but they are neither dumb nor despotic. Intuitions can be shaped by reasoning, especially when reasons are embedded in a friendly conversation or an emotionally compelling novel, movie, or news story. But the bottom line is that when we see or hear about the things other people do, the elephant begins to lean immediately. The rider, who is always trying to anticipate the elephant's next move, begins looking around for a way to support such a move. When my wife reprimanded me for leaving dirty dishes on the counter, I honestly believed that I was innocent. I sent my reasoning forth to defend me, and it came back with an effective legal brief in just 3 seconds. It's only because I happened at that very moment to be writing about the nature of moral reasoning that I bothered to look closely at my lawyer's arguments and found them to be historical fictions based only loosely on real events. Why do we have this weird mental architecture? As hominid brains tripled in size over the last 5 million years, developing language and a vastly improved ability to reason, why did we evolve an inner lawyer rather than an inner judge or scientist? Wouldn't it have been most adaptive for our ancestors to figure out the truth, the real truth about who did what and why, rather than using all that brain power just to find evidence in support of what they wanted to believe? That depends on which you think was more important for our ancestors' survival, truth or reputation. Chapter 4. Vote for me. Here's why. Suppose the gods were to flip a coin on the day of your birth. Heads, you will be a supremely honest and fair person throughout your life, yet everyone around you will believe you're a scoundrel. Tails, you will cheat and lie whenever it suits your needs, yet everyone around you will believe you're a paragon of virtue. Which outcome would you prefer? Plato's Republic, one of the most influential works in the Western canon, is an extended argument that you should pick heads for your own good. It is better to be than to seem virtuous. Early in the Republic, Glaucon, Plato's brother, challenges Socrates to prove that justice itself, and not merely the reputation for justice, leads to happiness. Glaucon asks Socrates to imagine what would happen to a man who had the mythical ring of Gyges, a gold ring that makes its wearer invisible at will. Quote, "Now no one, it seems, would be so incorruptible that he would stay on the path of justice or stay away from other people's property when he could take whatever he wanted from the marketplace with impunity, go into people's houses and have sex with anyone he wished, kill or release from prison anyone he wished, and do all the other things that would make him like a god among humans. Rather, his actions would be in no way different from those of an unjust person, and both would follow the same path." End quote. Glaucon's thought experiment implies that people are only virtuous because they fear the consequences of getting caught, especially the damage to their reputations. Glaucon says he will not be satisfied until Socrates can prove that a just man with a bad reputation is happier than an unjust man who is widely thought to be good. It's quite a challenge, and Socrates approaches it with an analogy. Justice in a man is like justice in a city, a polis or city-state. He then argues that a just city is one in which there is harmony, cooperation, and a division of labor between all the castes. Farmers farm, carpenters build, and rulers rule. All contribute to the common good, and all lament when misfortune happens to any of them. But in an unjust city, one group's gain is another's loss, faction schemes against faction, the powerful exploit the weak, and the city is divided against itself. To make sure the polis doesn't descend into the chaos of ruthless self-interest, Socrates says that philosophers must rule, for only they will pursue what is truly good, not just what is good for themselves. Having gotten his listeners to agree to this picture of a just, harmonious, and happy city, Socrates then argues that exactly these sorts of relationships apply within a just, harmonious, and happy person. If philosophers must rule the happy city, then reason must rule the happy person. And if reason rules, then it cares about what is truly good, not just about the appearance of virtue. Plato, who had been a student of Socrates, had a coherent set of beliefs about human nature, and at the core of these beliefs was his faith in the perfectibility of reason. Reason is our original nature, he thought. It was given to us by the gods and installed in our spherical heads. Passions often corrupt reason, but if we can learn to control those passions, our God-given rationality will shine forth and guide us to do the right thing, not the popular thing. As is often the case in moral philosophy, arguments about what we ought to do depend upon assumptions, often unstated, about human nature and human psychology. And for Plato, the assumed psychology is just plain wrong. In this chapter, I'll show that reason is not fit to rule. It was designed to seek justification, not truth. I'll show that Glaucon was right. People care a great deal more about appearance and reputation than about reality. In fact, I'll praise Glaucon for the rest of this program as the guy who got it right, the guy who realized that the most important principle for designing an ethical society is to make sure that everyone's reputation is on the line all the time, so that bad behavior will always bring bad consequences. William James, one of the founders of American psychology, urged psychologists to take a functionalist approach to the mind. That means examining things in terms of what they do within a larger system. The function of the heart is to pump blood within the circulatory system, and you can't understand the heart unless you keep that in mind. James applied the same logic to psychology. If you want to understand any mental mechanism or process, you have to know its function within some larger system. Thinking is for doing, he said. What, then, is the function of moral reasoning? Does it seem to have been shaped, tuned, and crafted by natural selection to help us find the truth, so that we can know the right way to behave and condemn those who behave wrongly? If you believe that, then you are a rationalist, like Plato, Socrates, and Kohlberg. Or does moral reasoning seem to have been shaped, tuned, and crafted to help us pursue socially strategic goals, such as guarding our reputations and convincing other people to support us or our team in disputes? If you believe that, then you are a Glauconian. We are all intuitive politicians. If you see 100 insects working together toward a common goal, it's a sure bet they're siblings. But when you see 100 people working on a construction site or marching off to war, you'd be astonished if they all turned out to be members of one large family. Human beings are the world champions of cooperation beyond kinship, and we do it in large part by creating systems of formal and informal accountability. We're really good at holding others accountable for their actions, and we're really skilled at navigating through a world in which others hold us accountable for our own. Phil Tetlock, a leading researcher in the study of accountability, defines accountability as the explicit expectation that one will be called upon to justify one's beliefs, feelings, or actions to others, coupled with an expectation that people will reward or punish us based on how well we justify ourselves. When nobody is answerable to anybody, when slackers and cheaters go unpunished, everything falls apart. How zealously people punish slackers and cheaters will emerge in later chapters as an important difference between liberals and conservatives. Tetlock suggests a useful metaphor for understanding how people behave within the webs of accountability that constitute human societies. We act like intuitive politicians striving to maintain appealing moral identities in front of our multiple constituencies. Rationalists, such as Kohlberg and Turiel, portrayed children as little scientists who use logic and experimentation to figure out the truth for themselves. When we look at children's efforts to understand the physical world, the scientist metaphor is apt. Kids really are formulating and testing hypotheses, and they really do converge gradually on the truth. But in the social world, things are different, according to Tetlock. The social world is Glauconian. Appearance is usually far more important than reality. In Tetlock's research, subjects are asked to solve problems and make decisions. For example, they're given information about a legal case and then asked to infer guilt or innocence. Some subjects are told that they'll have to explain their decisions to someone else. Other subjects know that they won't be held accountable by anyone. Tetlock found that when left to their own devices, people show the usual catalog of errors, laziness, and reliance on gut feelings that has been documented in so much decision-making research. But when people know in advance that they'll have to explain themselves, they think more systematically and self-critically. They are less likely to jump to premature conclusions and more likely to revise their beliefs in response to evidence. That might be good news for rationalists. Maybe we can think carefully whenever we believe it matters. Well, not quite. Tetlock found two very different kinds of careful reasoning. Exploratory thought is an even-handed consideration of alternative points of view. Confirmatory thought is a one-sided attempt to rationalize a particular point of view. Accountability increases exploratory thought only when three conditions apply. 1. Decision-makers learn before forming any opinion that they will be accountable to an audience. 2. The audience's views are unknown. And 3. They believe the audience is well-informed and interested in accuracy. When all three conditions apply, people do their darndest to figure out the truth because that's what the audience wants to hear. But the rest of the time, which is almost all of the time, accountability pressures simply increase confirmatory thought. People are trying harder to look right than to be right. Tetlock summarizes it like this. quote, "A central function of thought is making sure that one acts in ways that can be persuasively justified or excused to others. Indeed, the process of considering the justifiability of one's choices may be so prevalent that decision makers not only search for convincing reasons to make a choice when they must explain that choice to others, they search for reasons to convince themselves that they have made the right choice." End quote. Tetlock concludes that conscious reasoning is carried out largely for the purpose of persuasion rather than discovery. But Tetlock adds that we are also trying to persuade ourselves. We want to believe the things we are about to say to others. In the rest of this chapter, I'll review 5 bodies of experimental research supporting Tetlock and Glaucon. Our moral thinking is much more like a politician searching for votes than a scientist searching for truth. 1. We are obsessed with polls. Ed Koch, the brash mayor of New York City in the 1980s, was famous for greeting constituents with the question, "How am I doing?" It was a humorous reversal of the usual New York, "How you doing?" But it conveyed the chronic concern of elected officials. Few of us will ever run for office, yet most of the people we meet belong to one or more constituencies that we want to win over. Research on self-esteem suggests that we are all unconsciously asking Koch's question every day in almost every encounter. For 100 years, psychologists have written about the need to think well of oneself. But Mark Leary, a leading researcher on self-consciousness, thought that it made no evolutionary sense for there to be a deep need for self-esteem. For millions of years, our ancestors' survival depended upon their ability to get small groups to include them and trust them. So if there's any innate drive here, it should be a drive to get others to think well of us. Based on his review of the research, Leary suggested that self-esteem is more like an internal gauge, a sociometer, that continuously measures your value as a relationship partner. Whenever the sociometer needle drops, it triggers an alarm and changes our behavior. As Leary was developing the sociometer theory in the 1990s, he kept meeting people who denied that they were affected by what others thought of them. Do some people truly steer by their own compass? Leary decided to put these self-proclaimed mavericks to the test. First, he had a large group of students rate their self-esteem and how much it depended on what other people think. Then, he picked up the few people who, question after question, said they were completely unaffected by the opinions of others, and he invited them to the lab a few weeks later. As a comparison, he also invited people who had consistently said that they were strongly affected by what other people think of them. The test was on. Everyone had to sit alone in a room and talk about themselves for 5 minutes, speaking into a microphone. At the end of each minute, they saw a number flash on a screen in front of them. That number indicated how much another person listening in from another room wanted to interact with them in the next part of the study. With ratings from 1 to 7, where 7 is best, you can imagine how it would feel to see the numbers drop while you're talking. 4, 3, 2, 3, 2. In truth, Leary had rigged it. He gave some people declining ratings, while other people got rising ratings. 4, 5, 6, 5, 6. Obviously, it's more pleasant to see your numbers rise. But would seeing either set of numbers, ostensibly from a complete stranger, change what you believe to be true about yourself, your merits, your self-worth? Not surprisingly, people who admitted that they cared about other people's opinions had big reactions to the numbers. Their self-esteem sank. But the self-proclaimed mavericks suffered shocks almost as big. They might indeed have steered by their own compass, but they didn't realize that their compass tracked public opinion, not true north. It was just as Glaucon said. Leary's conclusion was that, quote, "The sociometer operates at a non-conscious and pre-attentive level to scan the social environment for any and all indications that one's relational value is low or declining," end quote. The sociometer is part of the elephant. Because appearing concerned about other people's opinions makes us look weak, we, like politicians, often deny that we care about public opinion polls. But the fact is that we care a lot about what others think of us. The only people known to have no sociometer are psychopaths. Our in-house press secretary automatically justifies everything. If you want to see post-hoc reasoning in action, just watch the press secretary of a president or prime minister take questions from reporters. No matter how bad the policy, the secretary will find some way to praise or defend it. Reporters then challenge assertions and bring up contradictory quotes from the politician or even quotes straight from the press secretary on previous days. Sometimes you'll hear an awkward pause as the secretary searches for the right words. But what you'll never hear is, "Hey, that's a great point. Maybe we should rethink this policy." Press secretaries can't say that because they have no power to make or revise policy. They're told what the policy is, and their job is to find evidence and arguments that will justify the policy to the public. And that's one of the writer's main jobs, to be the full-time in-house press secretary for the elephant. In 1960, Peter Wason, creator of the four-card task from Chapter 2, published his report on the 2-4-6 problem. He showed people a series of three numbers and told them that the triplet conformed to a rule. They had to guess the rule by generating other triplets and then asking the experimenter whether the new triplet conformed to the rule. When they were confident they had guessed the rule, they were supposed to tell the experimenter their guess. Suppose a subject first sees 2-4-6. The subject then generates a triplet in response. 4-6-8? Yes, says the experimenter. How about 120, 122, 124? Yes. It seemed obvious to most people that the rule was consecutive even numbers. But the experimenter told them this was wrong, so they tested out other rules. 3-5-7? Yes. What about 35-37-39? Yes. Okay, so the rule must be any series of numbers that rises by 2? No. People had little trouble generating new hypotheses about the rule, sometimes quite complex ones. But what they hardly ever did was to test their hypotheses by offering triplets that did not conform to their hypothesis. For example, proposing 2-4-5, yes, and 2-4-3, no, would have helped people zero in on the actual rule, any series of ascending numbers. Wason called this phenomenon the confirmation bias, the tendency to seek out and interpret new evidence in ways that confirm what you already think. People are quite good at challenging statements made by other people, but if it's your belief, then it's your possession, your child almost, and you want to protect it, not challenge it and risk losing it. Deanna Kuhn, a leading researcher of everyday reasoning, found evidence of the confirmation bias even when people solve a problem that is important for survival, knowing what foods make us sick. To bring this question into the lab, she created sets of 8 index cards, each of which showed a cartoon image of a child eating something, chocolate cake versus carrot cake, for example, and then showed what happened to the child afterward. The child is smiling or else is frowning and looking sick. She showed the cards one at a time to children and to adults and asked them to say whether the evidence, the 8 cards, suggested that either kind of food makes kids sick. The kids, as well as the adults, usually started off with a hunch, in this case, that chocolate cake is the more likely culprit. They usually concluded that the evidence proved them right. Even when the cards showed a stronger association between carrot cake and sickness, people still pointed to the 1 or 2 cards with sick chocolate cake eaters as evidence for their theory, and they ignored the larger number of cards that incriminated carrot cake. As Kuhn puts it, people seem to say to themselves, "Here is some evidence I can point to as supporting my theory, and therefore the theory is right." This is the sort of bad thinking that a good education should correct, right? Well, consider the findings of another eminent reasoning researcher, David Perkins. Perkins brought people of various ages and education levels into the lab and asked them to think about social issues such as whether giving schools more money would improve the quality of teaching and learning. He first asked subjects to write down their initial judgment. Then he asked them to think about the issue and write down all the reasons they could think of on either side that were relevant to reaching a final answer. After they were done, Perkins scored each reason subjects wrote as either a "my side" argument or an "other side" argument. Not surprisingly, people came up with many more "my side" arguments than "other side" arguments. Also not surprisingly, the more education subjects had, the more reasons they came up with. But when Perkins compared fourth-year students in high school, college, or graduate school to first-year students in those same schools, he found barely any improvement within each school. Rather, the high school students who generate a lot of arguments are the ones who are more likely to go on to college, and the college students who generate a lot of arguments are the ones who are more likely to go on to graduate school. Schools don't teach people to reason thoroughly. They select the applicants with higher IQs, and people with higher IQs are able to generate more reasons. The findings get more disturbing. Perkins found that IQ was by far the biggest predictor of how well people argued, but it predicted only the number of my side arguments. Smart people make really good lawyers and press secretaries, but they are no better than others at finding reasons on the other side. Perkins concluded that, quote, people invest their IQ in buttressing their own case rather than in exploring the entire issue more fully and even-handedly, end quote. Research on everyday reasoning offers little hope for moral rationalists. In the studies I've described, there is no self-interest at stake. When you ask people about strings of digits, cakes and illnesses, and school funding, people have rapid, automatic, intuitive reactions. One side looks a bit more attractive than the other. The elephant leans ever so slightly, and the rider gets right to work looking for supporting evidence, and invariably succeeds. This is how the press secretary works on trivial issues where there is no motivation to support one side or the other. If thinking is confirmatory rather than exploratory in these dry and easy cases, then what chance is there that people will think in an open-minded, exploratory way when self-interest, social identity, and strong emotions make them want or even need to reach a preordained conclusion? 3. We lie, cheat, and justify so well that we honestly believe we are honest. In the United Kingdom, members of Parliament, or MPs, have long been allowed to bill taxpayers for the reasonable expense of maintaining a second home, given that they're required to spend time in London and in their home districts. But because the office responsible for deciding what was reasonable approved nearly every request, members of Parliament treated it like a big blank check. And because their expenses were hidden from the public, MPs thought they were wearing the ring of Gyges, until a newspaper printed a leaked copy of those expense claims in 2009. Just as Glaucon predicted, they had behaved abominably. Many MPs declared their second home to be whichever one was due for major and lavish renovations, including dredging the moats. When the renovations were completed, they simply redesignated their primary home as their secondary home and renovated that one too, sometimes selling the renovated home for a huge profit. Late-night comedians are grateful for the never-ending stream of scandals coming out of London, Washington, and other centers of power. But are the rest of us any better than our leaders? Or should we first look for logs in our own eyes? Many psychologists have studied the effects of having plausible deniability. In one such study, subjects performed a task and were then given a slip of paper and a verbal confirmation of how much they were to be paid. But when they took the slip to another room to get their money, the cashier misread one digit and handed them too much money. Only 20% spoke up and corrected the mistake. But the story changed when the cashier asked them if the payment was correct. In that case, 60% said no and returned the extra money. Being asked directly removes plausible deniability. It would take a direct lie to keep the money. As a result, people are 3 times more likely to be honest. You can't predict who will return the money based on how people rate their own honesty or how well they are able to give the high-minded answer on a moral dilemma of the sort used by Kohlberg. If the rider were in charge of ethical behavior, then there would be a big correlation between people's moral reasoning and their moral behavior. But he's not, so there isn't. In his book, Predictably Irrational, Dan Ariely describes a brilliant series of studies in which participants had the opportunity to earn more money by claiming to have solved more math problems than they really did. Ariely summarizes his findings from many variations of the paradigm like this. Quote, when given the opportunity, many honest people will cheat. In fact, rather than finding that a few bad apples weighted the averages, we discovered that the majority of people cheated, and that they cheated just a little bit. End quote. People didn't try to get away with as much as they